broadcasting on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
CJM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CJM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Segment of our show, Krista Zankowski and Adriana Colucci will be telling us a little bit about restless leg syndrome.
Well, my name is Carla D. Zankowski. I'm the executive director of the foundation, and I became involved with the foundation in about 2002 when my daughter was diagnosed with RLS, and we didn't know what was going on with her sleep. We, you know, told it was growing pains or it was all in her head, and as a nurse, I thought, we can do better. We need to get this kid diagnosed and treated so that she could get back to living her best life. So I came on the board and then came on as executive director in 2014, and, you know, have been steering the course of this organization forward.
So for those who might not be as familiar with some of the impact of RLS, can tell me a little bit about how it affects a person.
It affects every aspect of your life, but especially the ability to sleep. So the emotional components are real people. When you're not sleeping, we know that it affects your health, your emotions, your overall well-being. And it also can be isolating. Not able to participate in family functions or to travel or even just go to a movie or out to dinner. So these are real, you know, things that happen to people with RLS. But we, on the flip side, the foundation has virtual support group meetings. And those meetings allow people to connect, you know, five times during the month live with other people from around the globe. We don't turn anyone away ever. And so they can get the support and community that they need, or maybe get some tips or information on a provider in their area, or, you know, those sorts of exchanges of the information that occur on those virtual support groups are priceless for the person living with RLS.
So that being said, do you ever address any myths or misperceptions about RLS?
Yes. Every day at the foundation, we hear about different things that somebody may have read on the internet or, you know, heard from a friend, or sort of like wives tells, you know, such as putting different kinds of bars of soap under your sheets. I've heard Ivory, I've heard, you know, Irish Spring, I've heard Dove. You know, it's constantly evolving, but that's probably one of the biggest myths and gives me a chuckle, because if it had worked, I think we'd all be doing it and we wouldn't be here today talking about RLS.
Putting soap underneath
your sheets.
Time hearing of this, but that's, I honestly don't see how that would have an impact, so I'm a little taken aback here.
Not for a neurological condition that impacts sleep. Wow. Those are things that further delay diagnosis and treatment and getting people in with, you know, to get the care they need so that they can live their best life. So that's part of what we do, is putting out, you know, information and serving as a trusted source of information for the RLS community. Everything that we do is reviewed, approved, and by our scientific and medical advisory board to make sure that it is the most current, up-to-date information in the field and that it's valid. And, you know, and that's why you'll see citations in all of our materials, because we want people to go back and read that. Maybe they are interested in that, or that's something that resonates with them. We want them to go to that source. And you can go to PubMed.gov, read the abstracts of those articles, and if you want to purchase it, or you can. But if it's something that we do, we usually provide those. We do provide like the treatment guidelines, open access, so you can click on it, and it's available for free.
So does the foundation have any projects or events on the horizon?
We do. We actually have we have a summit coming up in August where we're going to discuss for a full day, 6 hours in depth, the new RLS treatment guidelines. The team of physicians who worked on that from the Scientific and Medical Advisory Board is going to spend a Saturday with our community to walk through the guidelines, why their changes have been made, and what are the new protocols. And then in September, we have a once-in-a-decade event occurring, the Peter Brooks International State of the Science Conference, where we're going to convene leaders in our communities as researchers, clinicians, patients. We are including the patient voice in this event as well. We will have short texts throughout, but we're also having on Thursday night, we will have a town hall for any patient or in attendance who has questions for, and get ideas, tips and tricks on how to manage their RLS, and you'll get more than one opinion, because I know providers say they all practice the same, but they don't. As a nurse, I could tell you there's just a little bit of how they prefer to have things done. So I think this would be a good idea for patients to learn that, you know, RLS is not a one-size-fits-all, but to get their questions answered. So, and Adriana, do you want to add, or my colleague Adriana is here as well today?
Yeah, no, just that we're very excited to host this, like Carla said, once-in-a-decade event. It's going to be a great way for researchers to connect, to network, to share the latest in research and news, but then we also bring in that patient component by hosting a town hall, so that way information is accessible to as many people as possible.
So,
I'd like to add a little more to that. With the RLS patients, their symptoms are often dismissed, and they are not validated, and so that is one of the goals here and within our service to the community at the RLS Foundation, is to validate people, get them the resources that they need, and to always be that, you know, human on the other end of the phone that can help guide them when they're in their difficult times. Because we know that, a disease is never, you know, one size fits all, and it changes throughout the decades of your life. So you have to be able to pivot. And, you know, when those moments come, I want them to ask us those answers so they can get that science-based information. We might be able to connect them with a quality care center if their RLS is out of control and we feel like they're kind of, you know, they've crossed that line into really severe cases. You know, going to that knowledgeable and experienced provider is a game changer. That means that they will see somebody who has dedicated their life to treating RLS patients that, you know, will get it from the time you walk in the door, and you're going to walk out with a plan on how to manage your
Oh, I think you froze for a second.
I did.
Yeah. You're back. Yeah. Just the last 10 seconds.
Okay. So I just want people to get back to living their best life.
So this next question is for both of you. In your time with the foundation, is there any success moment or story you'd like to share?
I'll let you go first, Adriana, if you'd like.
Yeah, sure. So I've been with the foundation for about 3 years in communications, and one of the resources that we offer is a quarterly magazine called Nightwalkers, and I've been overseeing that quarterly magazine for about 2 years of my time here, one of the special moments that I have with that magazine is in one of our virtual support groups. We had one of the support group leaders was talking about an article that was published in the magazine, and about 5 members who were in the support group just all held up their magazine, the Nightwalkers, the latest one that came out, and it just kind of showed me that, you know, people are really impacted by the stories that we put in that magazine. That's really what resonates with them, and sometimes it's not the research-based articles. Sometimes it's the poems that are submitted by members. Sometimes it's the stories that validate their experience. And so just watching Nightwalkers be something that, you know, our members read through and appreciate and take the advice that's in there has been really special.
One is more personal. When my daughter was first having these symptoms of RLS, I didn't know what it was. I didn't have sleep medicine training in nursing school. So I started putting descriptors of what she said about was going on in her legs, and up popped the RLS Foundation. And I saw that they were having a patient meeting in St. Louis, but they closed registration. So I emailed the executive director. I would have paid anything to get in at that point. But they let me in. I went to that conference, and I learned everything that I could about RLS there. And I decided to get involved with the organization. But through the meeting, going to support groups, I would drive to – I live in Austin. I would drive to San Antonio. I was able to craft a plan of care for my daughter from – all of these bits of information I was able to get reading research articles. I actually wrote the first pediatric guideline with Dr. Dan Picchetti, you know, for that was a patient brochure that we handed out because we are, both of our families are impacted by RLS. But, you know, this foundation, gave us a segue to getting the best treatment, allowing my daughter to function in school when she was not doing well. You know, we were brought in and, you know, basically told that we were, you know, bad parents, that we didn't have, we need to set up guidelines and expectations in our house. And, you know, my daughter was falling asleep in class. We're letting her stay up late, and they was like, time out. You know, that's not what's going on. I think, you know, there's something more going on. And I'd like to know what you're seeing at school besides that, because here's what we do at home, and I'd like to set the record straight. So eventually, you know, I put in some safeguards in 504s, and that would give her some accommodations in her classroom. I'm segueing into something different. But it's important to know that you can create, you know, environments where the child is protected so that they have to put accommodations in place, that you can avoid the labeling and allow for education. So that's what we did, is that we would go in each year, and eventually she would take this over by high school, to educate her teachers and even the school nurse about RLS so they could know what her symptoms were, you know, not putting her in the front of the room if she was having a difficult day. Maybe I would ask for the back of the room so that she would need to stand, or to space her classes up so she would have to walk further between classes instead of the classroom next door, PE at lunchtime, right after lunch instead of early in the morning, so that we could allow time for movement in the day. But all those things I learned from my friends at the foundation, from our materials, but also from peers in the communities whose children had chronic conditions as well.
I'd like to thank you both for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. In this segment of our show, Jamie Ruggiver will be sharing his insights on Up About Down. So what can you tell me about your work with Up About Down?
So I started being involved in the group in about 2018. Our daughter was born in 2016. She's our first and only child. We didn't know she would have Down syndrome until she was born. The first couple of years, it was touch and go. She had a couple surgeries, so we didn't really quite have time for anything to do with the organization yet. It was kind of trying to survive. But once we joined the group, it was nice going to activities to just chat with other parents. And then in about 2018, there was an opening for a group leader who plans activities. So I kind of jumped in to fill the gap, and I've been with it ever since.
So, as a parent, and obviously a concerned citizen yourself, can you tell me a little bit about the sense of community that Up About Down has given you? How has it helped you deal with your daughter's situation?
Well, honestly, it was scary being a first-time parent and, you know, being told that your daughter needs heart surgery at only about 5 months old. No other friends or family I had been through that or could actually relate. So it was nice having a group of people that have been through similar things and, you know, were able to give me advice or tips or, you know, let us know what to expect. It was great to have people that have been in my shoes, kind of thing.
So you mentioned you help plan activities for the clients of About Down. Tell me a little bit about some of the things that they most enjoy.
So there's four different age groups, 0 to 5, 6 to 12, the teen, and then we have adult. So each group has their own leader, and they do, it's up to them to organize age specific. So right now my daughter's in the 6 to 12 age group. We just did this past weekend an outing at Adventure Bay Water Park in Windsor. We were able to basically use the facilities as a group and just kind of relax and unwind. But one of their favorite things we've put together is weekly gym rentals, where I bring different equipment and we have different structured activities mixed with their own playtime, free time to kind of do whatever they want. It's great seeing them build bonds and socialize with each other.
Do you ever encounter any myths or stereotypes concerning Down syndrome?
I would say probably all the time. People who don't know, and I don't think it's coming from a dark place. It's just, you know, they don't know. They want to know, you know, if you have a certain degree of Down syndrome, which, you know, isn't the case. If you have a copy of the third chromosome, you have Down syndrome. There's no different degrees. I think it's more so like when I was growing up and in school, I didn't go to school with anyone who had it. You know, it wasn't really around back then, whereas I feel like this generation, the school system's doing a lot better job of being inclusive. So, I mean, when you see it every day, it's not different. It's not, you know, everybody's a bit more educated.
So, in your time with Up About Down, is there any success moment or story that stands out for you you'd like to share?
Ooh, that's a great question. I mean, honestly, I'd say the best successes would be, you know, when we started these gym classes. Because our kids were pretty young when I got into this group, when we would do activities, they were very shy. You know, you would see each other maybe once every couple months, right? So when we started doing our gym activities or events more regularly, you just saw kind of the kids come out of their shell and be themselves and be comfortable around each other, be comfortable in the environment. And that was really the whole purpose of this, is so they could build meaningful relationships with each other.
So, do you have any advice for parents out there who might be struggling with the same questions you had? Can my child still have a full life? Are there supports? Is there hope?
Yeah, I mean, I would say definitely look and see if there's any kind of group or organization like I mean, if it's Down syndrome, reach out to our group, Up About Down, obviously. But, I mean, really any kind of disability. There's lots of programs and funding out there. Unfortunately, unless you look it up or happen to come across it, it's hard to find. But having a social network of parents, you know, really helps discover a lot of things that could help you out.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Absolutely.
Andy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Canadian Human Trafficking Hotline is now live to help victims and survivors get vital social and emergency services. If you need help or want to help stop human trafficking, call 1-833-900-1010.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard a little bit about restless leg syndrome from Krista Dzienkowski and Adriana Colucci. And Jamie Ruggeber filled us in on the latest with Up About Down. In this segment of our show, Sarnia Mayor Mike Bradley will be sharing his thoughts on the impact of the recent supply shortages on the disability community. So with the recent spike in prices and materials being unavailable, What's the potential impact on the disability community?
Well, I think it's huge. No different than the impact on the entire population. And these are fundamental issues to how people live. You know, the price of gas and food and the inflation that comes with that right now, it can be devastating to someone's income. You've planned your year on this basis, and now it's totally changed.
Okay. Well, that brings up an interesting question. With the potential increase of minimum wage coming up, will there be any impact on ODSP, for example?
Well, my own belief is the government of Ontario years ago should have brought that into a living wage for people. The minimum wage increases, they're welcome, but they're not of a substance that would make a huge difference in people's lives. And for those that are on, you know, disability benefits or whatever, I'm sure many saying, I don't see a way out of this. Unless there's a dramatic decrease or there's ways of helping them. And the one way they can be helped is by increasing substantially. You know, I don't want to use the cliche of the day right now. When you look at the government can afford to buy a $30 million plane, even though they retreated on that issue, and you look at where are your priorities. And the whole issue of people on disability and Ontario Works, all those issues, they're being left behind. They're being left behind, and it's a conscious move on the head of, by the provincial government, and it's just wrong.
So, are there any steps that individuals with disabilities can take in their own homes to get organized and get involved in pushing for change?
Well, I think one step, this fall there's a municipal election. Elect people who are advocates, strong advocates, not just the faux advocates that are out there, people that will speak up on these issues. And I come back to, you know, Ontario and at the federal level, we still do not have a focus or a minister who's devoted full-time to disability employment issues and disability access issues. And so with all the rhetoric you hear from governments about access and disability support, the actions aren't mirroring that. And we've been saying this, also, us who have been championing this issue, for many years. And yet it's easy to brush us aside and say, you know, there's more important priorities. Well, this to me is a fundamental way how we live as Canadians.
So in your own city of Sarnia, what have you seen happening as a result of all this rate hike?
Well, I think where I'm seeing it the most now, our rental rates have come down. I think that's happening right across the province and country. But there are a lot of people trapped. We're dealing with a whole rent eviction issue where landlords are trying to vacate apartments with people often on fixed incomes, often on disability, you know, under the pretext or that they have a relative moving in, blah, blah, blah. And there's enough that going on that places like London, Hamilton, we're looking at how to do it to protect people. But can you imagine if you've been living in an apartment for 10, 15 years, like some of the people I've spoken to, and you're on disability income or whatever, and you go from paying $800 or $900 to a new apartment at $2,000 or so, you just can't do it. Who can produce that type of income when you're on a truly fixed income?
On the positive side, with the increase of ODSP being indexed to inflation, that's at least some progress, but what are your thoughts on whether...
That is helpful to index to inflation, but let's remember the long period of time when there was no change in it, no change at all. So I think it needs a substantial bump to get people to a living wage, and to then continue to index. Index is a good thing. The inflation rate has gone up in the last month or two, so that all helps. But it's got to be overwhelming for people that just see a huge increase in the cost of living, and they can't get to a place to find the funds to help them survive. So that's why, again, we're having people out on the street, people that were good people, rents got out of control, inflation gets out of control, and it forces them into a life that they do not desire or do they deserve.
So do you see any potential for any sort of remedy to all this down the road, getting back to where people can live, if not comfortably, at least sustainably?
Well, one of the big issues, which I've been a champion on for 30 years, it's a lonely one on occasion. There has been some more support coming in for a living wage, a guaranteed income. And it's been proven it can work. And Ontario was looking to do that when Ford was first elected. He said he was going to support it, then he went the other way. We still haven't proven if it doesn't work. And during COVID, we had a lot of people on income from the federal government trying to get them through the crisis, and I would make the case it worked. So until you get to the base issue, which is a livable income so people can, you know, afford their, where they live, can afford groceries, can afford gasoline, you're just dog paddling. You're just dog paddling every day trying to decide, do I pay the hydro bill or do I pay the gas bill? What do I do? Because I have to make choices, when sometimes you should not be in that position to have to make choices.
So that being said, a living wage today might not be a living wage tomorrow. So I'm assuming that any plan for this would include regular increases to match the needs out there.
It would have to. It also needs a scrutiny system so that people aren't abusing it. But it's a big leap for most governments right now when they're, you know, they're in a mixed economy. We've got the tariff issue still with the states and all the other thing conflicts that are going on. But it does need a bold stroke if you want to show that we're a caring country and society. You just can't keep doing the same thing we've been doing now for decades as it relates to those on disability, those that cannot go out into the workplace. We just leave them and we pigeonhole them over here. And we're not addressing the fundamental changes that are needed to give them a better life. And in turn, that's better for a community and it's good for a country.
Right. Thank you for taking the time out to do this. But if you can stand for a sec, that'd be great. Simple truth, my friends, is in economic times like these, it can be easy to look at only our own needs, only what's good for us and those we care about. The truth is, we have to look beyond all that. For someone with a disability, the needs are no less vital, but the expenses can be a lot greater. The truth is, sometimes it takes having someone we care about having a disability to get us involved. But that's not the only reason. Open hearts and open minds can also lead us to care about what happens in the disability community. But the truth is, it affects us all. There is no family, no group in society that is untouched and unmoved by disability life. Pulling together, even in hard times, can make all the difference. Because honestly, folks with disabilities could help stimulate the economy if given the right opportunity. They bring new ideas, new potentials, new innovations to the table. They know what works for them and what doesn't. They tend to get things done in the most practical way possible. We all hear the horror stories about the way things are right now, supply shortages, tariffs, inability to get from A to B. But really, we should let the disability community be a part of the solution, not seen as the problem. Coming to work alongside folks with disabilities, helping them to reach their best, you might find they help you to reach your best. For an open mind does not go back to its original proportions, someone once said. And honestly, working together, we can help to create a better economy, a better workforce, better hope in these unsettled times. You come to realize very quickly the more time you spend around someone with a disability, you come to realize they are a person with hopes, dreams, loved ones, potentials, all their own. Really, there's no one's place to put a glass ceiling on, to say you will only be this or you can only do that. I always encourage folks with disabilities to explore their own potentials. If you have an idea that might help change the situation, go with it. See what it turns into. It might lead to a dead-end street. It might lead to someone building on your work. It might lead to an answer. It's not about immediately solving all the problems, my friends. It is about taking steps in that direction. And honestly, the disability community, as the thread that runs through us all, must be a part of finding economic solutions, transportation solutions, maybe just the next innovation. Because without the disability community, we're not complete as a people. I love it when people take the first step, you know. They get involved because somebody they care about has been affected, but along the way, they can potentially help a great many more, because they recognize that if this can happen to one person, it can happen to others. And if you can fill that need, if you can do something to better the situation, open your heart, open your mind, move somebody's needle in the right direction. This has been Handy Link. I'm your host, Cam Wells.